Submit written comments will be available through WBAI's main webpage. Do you have to contribute to WBAI to access the meeting? Of course not. But why not?
I'm Anat Gerstein from Anat Gerstein, Inc. Helping nonprofits is what we do. Nonprofits are working in overdrive to respond to the pandemic. They're running homeless shelters, providing health and mental health services, caring for kids in foster care and homebound seniors and those who are hungry and much more. They're also delivering educational entertaining content straight to our homes, and they're doing it all with less. So let's come together to support nonprofits today. Look for the hashtag Support Nonprofits on social media to learn more.
I've been a WBAI listener for a long, long time, from Democracy Now! To the late and great Armand DeMille. I'm really appreciative on the fact that I'm on the revolutionary radio station right now in New York City.
I'm Josh Fox, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org, Revolution Radio.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program about science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. I am Jim Freund. We lost one of the greats in science fiction in the last days of November, Ben Bova, due to COVID-related causes. He was 88 and therefore at high risk. I'd worked with Ben on a few projects many years ago when he was the iconic editor of Analog and then Omni magazines. I was lucky enough to catch up with him and conduct his guest of honor interview as a remote recording for Hour of the Wolf in April of 2017 during the regional New York science fiction convention LunaCon. So it is 5:34, and we should begin. And let me explain a little bit of the format, which is that, believe it or not, this is intended to be a bona fide radio show. I will, in fact, assuming that the recording comes out, my little mic here, be broadcasting it over WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, or WBAI.org. When Ben was in New York at Analog Magazine, I got to visit his office a few times. This is actually about our third or fourth interview, but the first one in about 30 years.
And give or take a few weeks.
Yeah, so we have a little bit of extra ground to cover, I suppose, making up for the lack of hair for both of us. I was a wild, long-haired youth, as it were. And Ben was the person who took me out once, a thrilling thing that I was recalling to my partner just the other day. You took me to the Algonquin.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the only time I've been in Dorothy Parkerville and Robert Venschleyville. And it's a thrill to see you.
It's good to see you.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's start out, you know, we don't have to be chronological or anything like that, but you have been involved in the space industry. Yeah. You've written jokes for Woody Allen.
One joke. Oh, right.
One joke. Tin foil.
Yeah.
I remember that. Looking up his bio on Wikipedia, it mentions other movies. It doesn't mention that Ben has a movie credit on Sleeper. And...
I don't think I've got a credit on Sleeper. I've watched the film several times.
In the closing
yeah, credits?
It's there. It's there. We freeze-framed it.
Oh.
To go, hey, look, there's Ben! As I don't even remember what the title was. Technical consultant, I think.
Perhaps.
How many movies and TV series, not counting the Star-Lost, have you worked on?
Two.
Only two. Okay. Nothing ever really... Yeah, Brillo, at one point, was going to be a TV show, and then they came up with...
It was Future Cop.
It was Future Cop.
Yes. And Harlan and I sued them.
Good.
And won.
Yes. So it wasn't that they really contracted with you. They just stole it from the story.
They worked with us without a contract, and I was surprised at this. I thought Harlan knew better, but I went along. with Harlan, and we came to a point where they wanted to use a human actor instead of the robot Brillo, and Harlan squawked and walked off. So they said, "That's it. We're finished." And next year they brought out our script. With the actor we suggested they use, Ernest Borgnine.
Right.
And another actor playing the robot.
Who you did not suggest.
I'd never heard of him. But
I don't remember who it was. I remember
Harlan
Borgnine.
Harlan took him to court.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other TV series was, of course, the infamously remembered The Star-Lost, which became the wonderful novel The Star-Crossed. Something good did come out of that.
Yeah.
You have the beginning of my question is the so many facets of your career, working in the aerospace industry, editor of two of the great science fiction, one science fiction magazine, the other Omni, which was an
magazine
Omni
magazine. Of the future.
Magazine of the future, exactly.
On sale today. That was one of their advertising lines.
It really was. The original name of the magazine, as I recall, was Nova.
Yes.
And PBS prevented...
They took Bob Guccione to court for stealing their name. And although this is entirely opposite 1,000 years of Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence, the court ruled that Guccione couldn't use the term Nova. So over a weekend, they went through every four-letter combination they could think of.
Including a few choice four-letter combinations for PBS.
They used a computer to generate four-letter words, and Nova was the one they picked. Omni was the one they picked.
Using the exact same cursive style.
It had to fit in the same piece because the cover was already laid out.
Wow.
And I thought Omni was a much better name anyway.
Actually, yes, I think it was. It's proved that way. And for them, Nova's so all's right as right can be.
Yep.
As far as that ended up.
Good always wins out over evil because it's nicer.
There you go. There you go. And let that be a lesson to Guccione.
No, he won.
Well, he won, yeah. Well, yeah, I guess, interesting. Okay, so I first met you not too long after you started at Analog was 72?
71, actually.
71.
Late 71.
Yeah, but we would have met about 72, 73. Yeah. I walk into his office, and there was a forest of Hugo Awards.
Well, those were all John Campbell's awards.
At that point.
Yes.
You started populating them.
Well.
How many Hugos?
Five.
Okay, but how many nominations?
Six.
Yeah, okay. Six was what was in my head.
Yes.
As best editor, and really made those magazines that you worked on distinctive and brilliant.
The writers made them distinctive and brilliant.
And who chose them?
What a difficult job. You get the best goddamn writing in the world, and you choose which one you want to put in the magazine.
Okay. So, aerospace industry, editor, fabulous writer of great hard science fiction, editor, still editing original anthologies and collection anthologies.
Yep.
Was the one that you did with Eric Choi the most recent? Carbon-tipped pens.
Thank you.
Stefan Rutnicki of Skyboat Media
yep.
produced the audiobook. I edited the audiobook. You're also outspoken, you've spoken out about politics, but you've been truly outspoken about religion.
No, I've got nothing to say about religion, which is about what it deserves.
You're against it.
I'm not against it. What people believe is what they believe. I just don't think it's a rational set of ideas.
Mm-hmm. Your life, I think, in all of these things, and I think that the programming at Lunacon has tried to reflect, your life has been about the future.
Yes. It's the only part of the universe that we can influence.
Mm-hmm.
We can't do a damn thing about the past. The present is just an instant. The future is what we can change, what we can build, what we can create. So we should think and cast our thoughts to the future and try to make it the best damn future we can imagine.
Mm-hmm. What ways would you see that? What paths, without naming names or getting into strict political discussion, but just in general terms.
We have an opportunity to move forward that the human race hasn't experienced since the invention of fire. We have the opportunity to move beyond the planet Earth, to begin to develop the resources of space and build new civilizations in space. And these new civilizations will invent new forms of government, new forms of how we live together. And they will change the history of the human race. We're on the cusp of stepping beyond planet Earth and building a new interplanetary and eventually interstellar civilization. And most of these new entities in space will change very much from what we have here on Earth. And one of the challenges will be to keep together, to not give up our humanity. But that's for future generations to decide. For the first time since, maybe 1776, we have a chance to build new worlds. And it's going to be interesting, to say the least.
You've always been the optimist.
There's so much to be optimistic about. I mean, look where we started.
Yeah.
A weak, clawless ape. And look where we are now. We're pushing all the other life forms on Earth into oblivion. There's 7.5 billion of us on Earth. There will be 10 billion by the middle of the century.
Right.
And we are a very successful species.
Yeah, that's a blessing and a curse.
Yes.
I've gotten hooked on a YouTube show that's on 6 hours a day of live safaris. They do a morning safari and an evening safari. Mm-hmm. It's all non-commercial. It's all free. And it's fascinating to watch. And what you learn is that these animals in Kruger Park, which is a huge area, they can no longer migrate.
Yeah.
They can no longer move across Africa because...
human buildings have gotten in the way.
Yeah. They have to... human intervention is the only thing that has also kept some of them alive by building water pens and the like. They're on survival watch. Some of these people give the cheetah less than 200 years because it needed to
move. I had an uncle who got less than 200 years.
For being a cheetah?
Among other things.
Okay. So, you know, that's part of being successful is at the cost.
We haven't learned to help the rest of the world be successful, too.
Yeah.
That's something that we have yet to accomplish.
How can we find balance?
By making people richer. This is why space is so important, because there's abundant wealth out there, enough to make every human being on Earth a multimillionaire. And this is how we can make the world better. Not a world where 90% is starving and 10% is incredibly wealthy, but a world where everybody is free and independent and shares the wealth, the abundance of the universe.
I love what you say.
Thank you.
I remain fearful about our ability to do that. You seem to have more
I've got more confidence faith. In the long-term intelligence of the human race. The fact that we can see it today as a problem means that it is something that we will solve in the future. This is why I'm interested in science fiction. Science fiction is about the future. And the only part of our lives that we have any influence over is the future. The past is gone. The present is a moment in time. Everything we do is aimed at what will the future be like, whether it's 10 minutes from now or 10 centuries from now.
Yes. A question.
Yes.
Are you happy with human progress, or do you think it has stalled, especially in regard to the space program?
Am I happy with human progress, especially with the space program? No, I'm not. I think if we kept pushing the way we did in the 50s and 60s, we could be having this interview on Mars.
Easily. I agree. But we've been chipped.
The potential is there, and we will develop it sooner or later.
Well, is it natural for it to pause and then continue, or does this put us in danger?
Some of both. I think it is natural to pause and then continue. But the longer you pause, the more danger you're in. There could come a time when we have so overpopulated this planet that we can no longer afford the luxury of moving off. So we're at a delicate moment in time.
How does science fiction, is a leading question, lead the way towards answers for this?
Science fiction shows you a myriad of possibilities of the future. It's like, I've always looked at it this way. Think of the history of the human race as a vast migration of people, billions of people, across the landscape of time. Science fiction writers are the scouts who go up ahead and they say, go this way, there's good water and there's grass. And don't go that way, it's a pitfall. And most people don't pay any attention. So we keep falling into pitfalls. But enough to do so that we find our way from one crisis to another. The science fiction writers, science fiction readers, are the scouts. We are the explorers. We are the dreamers. And that's what makes civilization progress.
How is the state of science fiction today compared to when you were last a magazine editor?
Well, I think it's terrific. I think, as usual, you know, where is science fiction going? In all directions at once. We offer a kaleidoscopic view of the future. You pick the one you like, or the ones that you like, and work to go in that direction. You know, a national politician in any nation today cannot think just about his own nation. He's got to think globally. We are a globally integrated society. And although there are vast differences from one place to another, we're all in this bucket together. And we're not going to get out of it. We're not going to see a great future. We're not going to see any future at all unless we solve the long-term problems. We're going to have 10 billion people on this planet in another 20 years. How do we feed them all? How do we educate them? How do we clothe them? It takes long-term vision to solve these problems.
Yeah. And how do you treat them well, I would add to that. Just, you know, common...
Well, I think the experience of America is the people treat themselves well.
Mm-hmm.
You don't expect the government to look after you. You look after the government.
One hopes.
It works.
Yeah, it can. It can.
Yep.
Sometimes the government can be an impediment when
short-term victories always look more important than long-term victories.
Yeah.
The politicians are always pushed to make the short-term decision.
Right. How can we move past that? Do you think that...
Experience,
mm-hmm.
education.
Do you believe in the a world government eventually?
No, I forget who said it, but somebody who's very smart... said, by the time we're ready for a world government, we won't need it.
Okay. I think I like the sound of that.
I think a world-class society is what we're building. We're all around the world, nations, individuals are moving toward a unified outlook, and if not a unified government, at least a unified approach, a cooperative approach to the problems of the world. And I think it's become clear almost all around the world that the problems of one nation cannot be solved without solving the problems of all the nations. We're all in this together.
Yeah, I just wish that I felt that a lot of other people felt that way.
They're learning. They're getting there.
Some are.
Yeah.
Some are. I'm always fearful of those that aren't. And
they'll die.
Unless they kill us. I grew up in... I'm born in 1953. So when I was young, I had mushroom-shaped nightmares. Mushroom cloud-shaped nightmares.
Yeah.
I am of that era.
Yeah.
And I've been having them again. Just looking at my fear of some of the world situation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we must escape.
We must prevent. We're not going to escape it. Once we invented nuclear weapons, once we invented weapons of mass destruction, they're there forever.
Yeah.
You can't erase that knowledge. The genie is out of the bottle. We've got to learn how to live with it.
Many of your books and your series take that very positive approach?
Well, if you look at the problems the human race has solved over the centuries, over the millennia, yeah, we've been a very successful race. And we don't just lay down and let it happen. We try to change things.
Now, at the same time that you're talking about these things and expressing this philosophy, you somehow manage to be damned entertaining when you do it.
Well, what is more entertaining than the problems that can kill you?
Well, I guess the proliferation of horror movies and stuff prove the people's desire for that.
They're all backward-looking.
Well, they are,
yes. They're all looking into the past.
Very much so. Very much so. I mean, the goriest of science fiction today, by a wonderfully gifted writer, Game of Thrones, is just reliving War of the Roses.
Yeah.
So I think you're absolutely right about that. I think there are a few exceptions to that in the horror genre. Kubrick.
Mm-hmm.
More so Kubrick than necessarily the writers upon whom he's based his horror work. I'll include Dr. Strangelove in that, by the way.
Well, it's not exactly a horror movie.
Well, I don't know. Nuclear destruction at the end.
I thought it was very funny.
Well, the way he did it, yeah.
Yes.
What else do you want to be doing at this point? But you asked. I'll try to answer. Number one is the written word. The storytelling around the campfire, and yeah. We record those now with the written word. Mm-hmm. Number two to that is reading that written word aloud. Mm-hmm. Number three, I think, is performing that in front of people, not just necessarily through recorded, as in movies, television, mm-hmm. means.
Live audience.
Live audience. Yes. And I have seen some darn fine science fiction on stage. Sometimes interpretations, sometimes original work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the why, because it's another medium in which you can share that entertainment and message.
Well, I think science fiction...
And it makes money.
But science fiction is very difficult to do, even in movies. You've got all the special effects available.
Mm-hmm.
Good science fiction is best, the best good science fiction I've ever seen is on a printed page.
Okay.
Very, very little in the movies and none that I know of in theater.
Are there any good hard science fiction movies that you've seen in, say, the last 10 years that you like? I was a big fan of Arrival. That's me.
Yeah. Dr. Strangelove was an interesting film.
Absolutely.
I'm trying to think. The one that Kubrick did, 2001.
Yes.
But
with that Clark guy, yeah.
Yeah. Had its shortcomings. There's one done back in the... Oh, The Man in the White Suit.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
It's a great science fiction
film. It's pure science fiction. Ealing Studios, starring Alec Guinness, and it's about invention and how it changes the life, not just of this person,
but the whole society.
But the whole society. It's a wonderful movie.
Man invents a fabric that can't get dirty and will never wear out. And the textile industry unites to destroy this man and his invention.
And he's saved by the fact that the invention eventually fails.
Yes. I thought was a cop-out.
It is. But they had to end it somehow. And then they wanted to give Alec Guinness a happy ending.
Yeah.
So...
it's a very funny movie. The Man in the White Suit. Run right out and rent a copy of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wouldn't be surprised.
How many of you have seen it?
You can watch it for free on YouTube these days.
I was going to say I wouldn't be surprised if you could find it on YouTube. It would be illegal, but don't let that... No, copy. It's a 1950s movie. Copyright is still good going back to 1927. So
2027
carries forward to, but it goes back. Something from 1928 is still under copyright, as long as it has been renewed. If it has not been dropped,
there are a lot of movies from the British studios, like Things to Come, that were not renewed.
That had to do with the sad fortunes of London Films, where the Cordas let a lot of their properties lapse.
And it was a lousy film.
Ralph Richardson ate all the scenery. He just... the scriptwriter was okay. Wasn't his best work, but...
He had too much influence over it.
Yeah, he wasn't really a great scriptwriter. Right.
So few of us are.
You've had your successes?
No.
You've had your failures?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Why haven't you had more success? You have the talent, you have the ability. People should know to listen to you, having watched.
It's a different form of writing. It's a different medium. It's like asking Van Gogh, why haven't you done any movies?
Well, Cocteau did, and he made some good ones.
And some stinkers. But we digress.
We digress. do we have questions for more on topic? Hello?
What do you think of Interstellar?
Didn't see it. That's what I think of it.
It's an attempt at hard science fiction, as is Inception by the same people. I was not a big fan. It had its moments, but I think that ultimately it failed. I think that Arrival succeeded where Interstellar failed.
Okay, well, I haven't seen any of them, and that's my fault.
I think you would be interested in Arrival. Ted Chiang's story, actually faithful to a difficult short story and a very good adaptation, and it's hard science fiction about a linguist and who is it that what is the science that Jeremy Renner plays? What is his discipline? Oh, come on, it's a science fiction convention. Nobody can remember that or name that. Okay, that was another question over here.
Ben, you're talking about humans or people in stories, in science fiction stories in the genre. Question for you, please. In all your works, have you ever made a love story? And if not, why not?
A love story?
Zero G.
All my novels are love stories. There's plenty of romantic interest in my novels.
Yeah. Oh, no, we just want to get you closer, to this microphone, which means I can't actually do it from here. If somebody could move that pedestal. Oh, okay. Can't see it. Okay. All righty. That's as far as it goes, but we can raise it a little. Or can we? No, it seems to be having Viagra problems. Okay. Love stories.
Yeah.
You've had sex stories.
Yep.
I remember. What's the name of it? Zero G.
Zero G.
Absolutely. There's a. Do people remember that story? Shame on you. Read it. It's a very funny, very clever. Thank you so much. Better.
Yes.
Better.
The new book, The New Earth, has a love story.
New Earth? Most of my novels have love stories.
The new earth is the one.
Part of the human existence.
Okay. Yes, question.
No, I was
waiting
up my voice.
Oh, okay. Well, why don't you have a question then?
Ask all my questions in the two others, everybody.
But he looks so good and uniform.
Now, the proper modern major general look over there. Everybody on the radio, I trust, can see that.
The gentleman actually does remind me that probably the most prevalent science fiction among young people, in my experience, right now at this time period, seem to be steampunk, which is going back to the Victorian science fiction and starting over, or dystopian science fiction rather than the kind of optimistic hard science fiction that you traditionally represent. Why do you think this is?
Education.
Excellent question, thank you.
Education. I don't think kids know about the possibilities of the future. Blame that squarely on our school systems.
But isn't that also the job of science fiction writers to help them?
Where we can only help them if they'll read the goddamn stuff.
Well, maybe if they're writing a little less, I don't know, a little less dystopia, a little less Hunger Games. I mean, it's an amazing thing that at the beginning of this year, with American politics having scared a few people, back on the bestseller list was one of the greatest science fiction novels ever written, 1984. Made its way to the bestseller list second week in January this year. Talk about dystopian. And what are the novels or stories? What are the stories that have been written that posit the world you want us to become? Can you name a few of them?
Excluding my own work.
No, including your own work.
Well, all of my stuff.
Okay. That's him. All of my stuff is an excellent title. But go on. Colony is really...
Thank you. Well, I can only go through the books that I loved.
Please, do that. Do just that.
An awful lot of Robert Heinlein. Green Hills of Earth was marvelous. Ray Bradbury, although Ray was more of a dystopian than most people realize.
Oh, yes. I mean, one of the great dystopian novels of all time is Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah.
And you know, a wonderful short story that he wrote, The Pedestrian. Do you remember that one?
Yes, I do.
That's a lovely little chilling...
I often thought it happened after Ray visited Boston, but I found he never did. But being a pedestrian in Boston is quite an adventure.
Yes. Hello. I thought I saw somebody raising a hand. Oh, I beg your pardon. Name some more books that you've liked that represent that ideal that you would like to impress upon people.
Yeah.
Or writers. I mean, you said Heinlein, certainly.
Yeah. My memory isn't what it used to be.
My memory is, as time goes on, we have to continue, as you say, looking forward.
Yes.
To the future. But there are things that influence us. What were your greatest influencers?
Oh, Kipling, Heinlein, Bradbury, John Campbell, both not so much as a writer, but as an editor.
Yes.
Alfred Bester.
Alfie Bester. What a wonderful person.
He never wrote a bad story.
Not capable of it.
Oh, I think he was capable.
Well, maybe so. And some of his scripts for The Shadow are pretty weird. Yeah. But the men who murdered Mohammed.
Yes.
You want to rate, you know, everybody always does, obviously, some of the great space operas he wrote. But some of his short stories, The Men Who Murdered Mohammed is one of the great classic. It's along with By His Bootstraps. Those are two of the great time travel stories ever.
One of the writers I really admired is Fritz Leiber.
Mm-hmm.
Fritz wrote in all sorts of genres and never wrote a dull story.
Pale of Air.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Other people? Mr. Engford.
Go back to the concept of dystopian novels. Your novel Colony, while life on the island, one colony, was fairly idyllic, the world it was set in, I would have to say, was fairly dystopian. The world government.
Yes.
Yeah.
The central part of the story was building a space war.
Yep.
And the people who financed the space colony, the principal was an oligarch who decided half of the colony was for him.
Yeah.
So would you consider that a dystopian setting for a hopeful novel?
Yes. I think that's a very good way to put it.
So despite your optimism for humanity's future, dystopian writing helps.
Shit happens.
I will broadcast that. There's no way around that. Yeah, so is it fair to say that while you have this optimistic look and hope and all that, that you are also a bit of a realist at the same time?
I try to be. I think there's no question that there's an awful lot wrong with human society.
Right.
But we're trying to make it better. You take a look at this country, the United States, where we started and where we've gone. If Ben Franklin could suddenly appear here, his little heart would break. He'd be so happy. We have come so far. We've solved so many problems.
Still using cash, though.
Yeah.
He tried to eliminate that.
Yeah,
he did try to eliminate that. I think his friend who's got a Broadway musical running right now changed that a bit.
I always like the character in Lou Abner, the comic strip.
Mm-hmm.
Is it General Bullmoose?
General Bullmoose. What's good for General Bullmoose is good for the USA.
And he had a dream as a little boy. He wanted all the money in the world. Now, you aren't going to interfere with the dreams of a little boy, are you?
What are your dark dreams?
Dark dreams?
Yeah. What are your fears? We know your optimism.
Oh, my fears are that we will ignore the problems that we have today. We won't take out the opportunities that we have today. And we'll just drift into an overpopulated, underfinanced dystopia.
Yeah. Due to myopic vision, would you say?
Yeah. Or worse than myopic vision, selfish vision. You know, what's good for me is all I'm interested in. The rest of you can all go to hell, and you probably will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
a danger.
Yeah, it is. I don't think we have anybody today like that in politics.
I can't think of a soul.
Can't think of a soul. We have about 5 minutes left.
Right.
What haven't we discussed that we should have?
Mm.
It's a cop out of a question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, there's.
I see.
It's almost hard to know where to begin with you because there's so many wonderful facets.
to your career.
I look at the history of the human race and see where we started in Old Ovi Gorge and where we have come, how far we've come. And then I look ahead and see how far there is still to go. And to quote a line from Rostand's play, Cyrano de Bergerac, where his friend is telling him, make friends, stop being such a hard ass. And he says, I see them making friends the way a dog makes friends. And I say to myself, here comes, thank God, another enemy. Well, I think the human race is reaching a point where we have the opportunity to change our society unalterably. And we should be very happy that we live in this generation, because we have the opportunity to move the human race to its next level of existence, to become an interplanetary society, to start new societies on new worlds, in new habitats. And for the first time since at least 1776, we have a chance to build new worlds. And I think it was Al Jolson who would always say, you ain't seen nothing yet. There's a great, great future up there for us. And it would take incredible acts of stupidity and avarice to avoid this future. It's going to happen. We're on our way.
Well, from your lips to the ears of those who can make it happen is all that I can say about that.
That's fine.
And hopefully let us, if other people haven't started spreading the word, let it spread from here.
Let the word go forth from this time and place that a new generation of Americans said. Great speech.
Oh, who is that?
John Kennedy's inauguration
speech. Okay. I knew it was somewhere in my lifetime, but it was in my ute. So it is 6:25. It is theoretically time for us to wrap up, but I think that as the guest of honor here, you have done science fiction. You've done Lunacon proud. You've done science fiction proud. You've done.
Thank you.
You've done the world a lot of good.
And why is it in such trouble?
Let the word go forth. You have given hope to some people.
Well, that's good.
That can change.
Yep.
That direction. And that's the way that we fight, is by speaking well. And letting people know the kind of message that you've been sharing during this hour.
So, yeah.
Okay, so let's take note of the trouble that we are in and say, stop now.
Start now.
Or start better yet.
Start now.
Better yet.
Move on.
Okay, so all I can say is I hope I can be a proxy on behalf of those of us who love reading fun, good, inventive, intelligent literature that will carry us into the future. Thank you, Ben Bova.
Thank you. Well, that was fun.
Good. You've been listening to an interview with Ben Bova, who passed away this past week at the age of 88 from COVID-related causes. Now it is time to hear Dan Persons' review of Minor Premise.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. I don't talk nearly enough about the importance of editing in film, and given the limited time Hot Wolf has these days, I'm not going to do it now either. Suffice it to say, I'm not alone in believing that editing is the secret sauce of filmmaking. Depending on how it's deployed, it can make or break a film. In the new science fiction film Minor Premise, which is now playing in theaters and is available through virtual cinema and on demand, please pick an online option if you want to watch, a reclusive neuroscientist, Ethan, played by Sathya Sridharan, tries to use a machine to boost his intelligence, but instead winds up fracturing his personality into 10 discrete aspects. Intellect, euphoria, anxiety, libido, etc., that cycle around every hour for 6 minutes apiece. It's up to Ethan and his colleague Allie, played by Peyton Ashbrook, to hunker down in his basement lab, search the notes of Ethan's illustrious father, and find a way to reintegrate his brain before it's too late. What too late entails, I'm not sure. It may have been explained, but it's got to be bad. You betcha. And while all this sounds more like a setup for comedy than drama, in fact, Mork and Mindy used a similar idea in its first season to allow Robin Williams to do his Robin Williams thing for a half hour, this could be the setup for an interesting examination of the human psyche. Instead, director Eric Schultz, who co-wrote the script with Justin Moretto and Thomas Torrey, has decided to try a fractured timeline gambit using cuts, ellipses. Ethan also suffers from random blackouts, which doesn't help, and glimpses back in time via video surveillance footage to show us the scientist at various stages of his dissolution. But we never get a full, coherent measure of what Ethan is going through, something that I'm guessing Sridharan would have leapt at the chance to portray, and it isn't helped by the introduction of the idea that Ethan can force himself to skip over certain phases, which helps in advancing the story, but does nothing for exploring the concept and just makes things more confusing. Add to that that Ethan and Allie perform several particularly heinous acts on another colleague, played by Dana Ashbrook, who's done nothing worse than being a right sphincter, and you have an exercise in character-driven SF that seems almost to be actively trying to push you away. Minor Premise tries to be daring with an intriguing idea, but just gets lost along the way. But if you're looking for some pure science fiction goodness, Film Forum has just released via virtual cinema a restoration of the 1963 Czechoslovakian space travel classic Ikari XB-1. And if you've only seen the American version titled Voyage to the End of the Universe, and even if you haven't, you've got to see this. It's based on a Stanislaw Lem novel, so of course it doesn't stint on weighing the emotional costs of space travel. And it's got lots of visually impressive moments, including one where the crew visits a derelict spacecraft filled with corpses of decadent capitalists. It was the early 60s. Ikari XB-1 is a prime example of visionary 1960s science fiction and an entrancing ride. And if you've got some time Sunday, December 6th, you can catch online the very first Black in Animation Award show hosted by Steven Universe's Estelle at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and you should. You can register now at bwabootcamp.com. That's bwabootcamp.com, and it's free. That's nice. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you for listening. I'm not sure if I'm scheduled to be on next week. There may be fundraising, but tune in regardless. I may be here. And don't forget that our next New York Review of Science Fiction's reading will be this Tuesday, December 8th, featuring Carlos Hernandez and Claire Cooney, hosted by Barbara Krasnoff. Just go to Facebook, to the NYRSF Readings Group at 7 p.m. on Tuesday, and Gremlins Willing, join us live. In the meantime, be well and be good. Stay tuned for Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Good morning.
During this season, what's supposed to be a holiday season, we thank you for being a contributor to WBAI. We hope you are still working, and if you are, we want you to know that many companies have matching gift programs for which even your premium gift donation can qualify. That means if you've donated $150 for a premium, much of this amount can be matched by your employer's matching gift program. Premium gift donations made way back in January of 2020 through the end of this year ending on December 31st, 2020 can be eligible for matches this year. This is money we didn't even know about here at WBAI. A listener brought this to our attention. The additional funds from the match would greatly help this listener-sponsored station receive the necessary funds to continue operating. For this matching gift program to work, WBAI needs to be in your employer's matching gift database. First, check your employer's matching gift database to see if WBAI is in it. If WBAI is not listed, please send an email to matchingfund@wbai.org, and we will make it easy for you to nominate WBAI. If WBAI is listed, please send your employer's match form for your premium gift donation directly to matchingfund@wbai. And please check our website under Donate for details. A WBAI listener summed up the match this way. She says, "What's so beautiful about employer matching gifts for premium gift donations is that it's workers' money that's already there. We just need to get it to WBAI.
I wear a mask for my fellow New Yorkers.
My mama, who's a healthcare worker.
Nurses and doctors.
For my father.
For the marginalized communities who don't have access to adequate healthcare.
For my children.
My community.
Essential workers.
Transit workers.
The immunocompromised.
I wear a mask so we can get back to work.
Go to school. Share a meal.
See a movie.
Hug my friends.
Dance together.
Go to the theater.
See our families.
Continue to show support.
Take care of each other.
Save lives.
Stay strong.
Audio Stages is taking a few weeks off from our regular fare of original radio musicals to take you on an excursion into another world. We've all heard stories of battles between good and evil, between villains and heroes, in the real world over property. But then there are stories about battles fought in the spirit world, also between good and evil, for the possession of human souls. Tune in this Saturday at 7 as Audio Stages presents Episode 2 of Rider at the Spirit Bell, an historic rebroadcast of this three-part radio drama series set in a blend of time and place, in the present and in an ancient world. Rider will transport you to places where you may have been without even realizing it. Rider at the Spirit Bell, Episode 2, WBAI, this Saturday at 7.
It's autumn. The birds and ear massage are migrating to Sundays, 6 to 8 a.m. I'm Mark Leosa, your ear masseur, inviting you to give ear to ear massage, sound, spoken word, a bit of opera, and maybe music you never heard before, including the Bird of the Week, ear massage between Jeff Brady and other news, and your Morning Ursae with James Ursae, here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Ear massage.
Extinction Diaries. There may have once been over 50,000 right whales in the Atlantic, up to 60 feet long, and named right whale because they were the easy right whale to hunt. Their numbers fell to just 100 individuals before being one of the first whale species protected in 1937. After only reaching just 500, a decline began, and by 2017 was accelerating when 18 individuals died. There were no births in 2018, and in 2019, a string of deaths made headlines as rights died entangled in fishing gear and boat strikes in the St. Lawrence region. Their numbers are now under 400 again. With the sixth great extinction spotlight on them, the right whale is like a canary in the coal mine, whose near-term future is an indication of just how successful humanity will be with our own survival. Without immediate, deep, and broad changes to how we treat the ocean, both the right whale and humans could share the same fate. My name is Cheyenne Sun Thunder. This is The Extinction Diaries, a Small World Radio production.
This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels. The Institute of the Black Whale 21st Century's Black Family Summit proudly announces the Community Cares Listening Line for Black first responders and essential workers. We're here and we're listening. The Community Cares Listening Line is a free, confidential service staffed with responsive volunteers who can provide emotional support and share information with our callers. If you're feeling anxious, afraid, distressed, burdened, or overwhelmed by a range of emotions, please call the Community Cares Listening Line at 877-719-1117. That's 877-719-1117.
WBAI accepts snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car.
Hi, this is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
Each day with a song. Now even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Or sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you'll even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft. Little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal. Hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song
than walking around with a face 11 miles long. Now you know that you can't go wrong. Yeah, 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 yeah. If you start off each day with a song.
I'm looking out the window and it's all rain here on Saturday, December 5th. It's the kind of day my sister and I would be kept indoors, play Monopoly, make fudge or popcorn. Most importantly, breathe on the windows would create a little fog and we'd finger our initials into the window panes. And that was a big day when it started to rain out there in Richfield Park, New Jersey. On a Saturday morning, my mother was not thrilled with the two of us left indoors all day. No options. Now, Donald Trump, in a last-minute gesture, would probably have the FCC contact me and have me drawn and courted if I didn't say that I'm David Rothenberg. The program's Any Saturday. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored radio in New York City. Maybe we can get Joe Biden to have somebody to alter that ritual. Maybe six times a day. Every half hour? Absurd. Well, about 150 years ago, General William Sherman marched through Georgia to the ocean. If you remember that scene in Gone with the Wind when the camera pulls back and the bodies all strewn throughout Atlanta, that was the result of a Yankee general coming into Georgia and desecrated the people, the countryside. And for over a century and a half, it's been part of Georgia folklore. Well, another Yankee's going down there today, and I make some predictions. His name is Donald Trump. And I think the most significant thing to realize is that in the last 2 weeks, there's been a slight change in the news. The name Joe Biden is popping up more than the name Donald Trump. Appointments for cabinets, plans to deal with the economy and the pandemic. Donald's popping up with alternate squeaks about fraud. But unless you listen to conspiracy radio and conspiracy Fox, you're not hearing so much of him. And psychotic narcissists don't do well when the attention, when the spotlight is focused elsewhere. So I suspect that what Donald's going to do or talk about today is to make himself the center of attention once again. He's going to say irresponsible or incendiary, forget the adjectives, anything that draws attention to him, that he will be the issue, not the four individuals running for the Senate, two Democrats and two Republicans in a playoff, a runoff, not a playoff, that's the NCAA, a runoff, which will determine who has the majority in the Senate. Poor Mitch McConnell just drooling, foaming, if you will. But I suspect that that's Donald's intent today is less about the future of the nation or the Senate or the Republican Party, but a chance to get in the spotlight again. He's going to have another maskless COVID-induced rallies. Let his flock be infected as long as he can get out there and bellow. That's today. Another president has been making the rounds of television, getting a lot of attention. His name is Barack Obama. He has a book out called It's the Promised Land. No, it's the Promised Something. I bought my copy. It's inside. I second. I will. I'll tell you the title because I have tomorrow's book review section in the Times. And it sold 835,000 copies in its first week. A Promised Land is the title. And he's been on everyone's show talking. Even Fox had some chatter with him. Very interesting. I love the Colbert interview. Colbert said, you know, with all due respect, and you know, I admired you very much as a president, 2 or 3 days would go by and I wouldn't hear from you, think about you. It was very refreshing. They both got a laugh about that. The obvious implication was that the current resident in the White House could not let an hour, much less a day, go by without being the factor in everyone's consideration for news. You know, presidents write books when they're finished. It took 4 years for Barack Obama's book to come out, the timing perfect. One wonders what Donald Trump will do and who will provide him with the crayons to finish his book about his presidency. Those are the things that we have to be concerned about. One thing in the Colbert interview, he asked Barack Obama, who's rather forthcoming on most questions, asked about the reality of UFOs. And if I understood the question correctly, and the former president of the United States said, I cannot answer that question. Interesting. Layers of questions underneath that. It's interesting watching Joe Biden and Kamala Harris on the news. You feel like the adults are in the room. Grown-ups talking about issues that might affect our lives. And Joe Biden showed a little bit of sense of humor. He said that he got a call from Bill Barr asking if he could be in the witness protection program. Funny. All part and parcel of what's going on in the world, or at least in our world today. The pandemic creating havoc across the country. The governor of Florida, DeSantis, a disciple of Trump, not wanting to have any restrictions on business. You know anyone who wants to go to Florida when Dade County announces that they have a 10% positive rate in COVID testing? It's not going to help business. Tourism is Florida's business. Can you imagine an influx of Europeans or Canadians or New Yorkers wanting to go down to Florida this winter? Absurd. I did say I'm David Rothenberg, but I didn't say we also play some music. And we'll start with the wonderful Nancy Lamott. Here's a Johnny Mercer R. Dolan song. Johnny Mercer wrote the lyrics. I don't know who Dolan is who wrote the music. But when there are certain songs, when you hear the lyrics, at least for me, I say, oh, that's a Mercer lyric. There's a kindness of it, a folksiness, a combination of sophistication and folksiness. Interesting. Nancy Lamott, if you will.
As sweet as apple pies. Whisper you tremble with a wild desire to light the fire in my eyes. Tell me I'm beautiful. Exaggerate.